Please note that microplastics have been a hot topic since we released the guidance in 2023. While ITRC training speaks to the content of the guidance document, we do have a couple updates on regulations in today's training. My name is Taylor Vogel, and I will be your moderator for today's training. So I'm now going to turn this over to Valerie Hanley from the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, one of the former team leaders for the microplastics team, to get us started with the training today.
Thank you so much, Taylor, and welcome everybody to today's training. We've got a lot of really good information to share with you. So let's go ahead and get started. Can we go to the next slide, please, Taylor? These are our wonderful trainers. They'll be walking you through this material. Everybody was part of our microplastics team and helped develop this training, and are very well versed in being able to answer your questions. And so, let's move forward to see what topics we're going to cover today. So this is a roadmap as to the topics that we're going to cover. As Taylor mentioned, there will be two Q&A sessions, one about halfway through, and then one at the end. You will use that Q&A pod to ask questions, and then we can answer them during those live sessions. As Taylor mentioned, the chat is to be used for our interactive case study that Alex will be introducing a little bit later. To get us started on that, I'm going to ask everybody to go ahead and use that chat and tell me one thing that you feel you know about microplastics. We'll give you about 20 seconds to do that, just to kind of get the information flowing and see where everybody is at. They are everywhere. They are ubiquitous. Absolutely. Difficult to define. Excellent. We'll talk about all those different definitions. It's on Mount Everest. They are in our brains. Less than 5 micrometers. Excellent. Synthetic fibers are a big contributor. Yep. So a lot of these things, I'll say we've been offering this training for a couple of years now. And I can tell through this chat function that the word about microplastics has gotten out a lot more than it was when we were first doing this. I feel like there's a lot more knowledge out there based off of your guys' comments. So that's good to know, and hopefully we will teach you some more stuff today. All right, next slide, Taylor. So, before I hand it off and we get into the introduction, I just wanted to say that overall, our goal with this document was to provide an understanding of microplastics and the state of the applied science so that you don't have to go to the scientific literature yourself. So, kind of like a big review of what is currently out there, what we know. As Taylor mentioned, we know that this is a rapidly expanding field, an emerging field, and so there's lots of changes. So we will discuss some of those changes today, but mostly we'll be focused on the guidance document that we completed in 2022, I believe. All right, next slide. All right, and with that, I'm going to hand it over to Dietschle Yardbici from DTSC, and she is going to go through the rest of our topics today in our introduction. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Valerie. Hello, everyone. This is Dietschle Yardımcı. I'm with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. And in today's training, we will cover introduction to microplastics and their sources, environmental distribution, fate, and transport of microplastics. We will also talk about sampling and analysis techniques of microplastics from various media. We also we'll cover human health and ecological effects of microplastics, as well as a section on the current regulations compiled on microplastics. And then we will finish out with mitigation and abatement techniques on microplastics. And with that, I'm going to take you to go back in time and start talking about how the plastic was invented and how that led to the plastic pollution problem today. The very first synthetic plastic was invented in early 1900s. And then from 1930s to 1945, there was an innovation of various plastics. But the biggest growth in the plastic industry didn't occur until 1950s. And in this plot here, you can see the plastic waste had a big uptick starting from 1950s, which is the same time frame with the growth of the plastic industry. And if we don't do anything about the plastic pollution, We will continue to see plastic waste accumulating in the environment, which is shown by the black dotted line on this plot here. And to tackle this problem from 1970s and beyond, there has been an innovation of bio-based and biodegradable plastics. But as we will talk about later in the training, these weren't a very good solution in terms of tackling the plastic pollution. And this bar chart shows in 2010, there has been a plastic production of 270 million tons every year globally. And within that same time frame, there was 275 million tons of plastic has been globally accumulating every year. Notice the plastic waste amount is actually higher than the production. That's because once you make the plastic, it starts to accumulate as waste in the environment. And over 99 million ton of that plastic ended up in as coastal plastic waste, with 31 million mismanaged, which puts about 8 million tons of plastic into the oceans every year. Tens and 100,000 tons of plastic ends up in surface waters. When we look at 2020, a decade later, the data is not shown here. The plastic production almost doubled in size, which one might expect the plastic waste to significantly continue to increase in the environment. And today's training topic is microplastics. And as a lot of you are aware, we are concerned about microplastics because they're everywhere. They are widespread in the environment. They are found in drinking water, in the air we breathe. They're in food and beverages that humans consume. They are found in remote locations, and they can accumulate and persist a long time in the environment. They can also contain harmful contaminants and additives, and they can move long distances through various environmental media and carry those contaminants along with them. Because of their small size, they can also be consumed by humans and other organisms and may cause adverse health impacts to humans and other organisms that are exposed to microplastics. And there is no universally accepted definition of microplastics, but there's a general consensus that microplastics are plastic particles less than 5 millimeter in size. An ITRC team looked through all the existing definitions on microplastics, and in our guidance document, we have defined microplastics as particles that are greater than 1 nanometer and less than 5 millimeters in their longest dimension that are made of solid polymeric materials to which chemical additives or other substances may have been added. Polymers that are derived in nature that haven't been chemically modified other than hydrolysis are excluded from this definition. And for context, hydrolysis is a reaction which breaks down polymers into their building blocks, which are called monomers, using water. And just as a side note, we will use a lot of terminology during the training, so you can find the definitions of those terms in the appendix section of our guidance document. Going back to the size range of microplastics, in our guidance document, we have defined the microplastic size ranging anywhere between from 1 nanometer up to 5 millimeters. This figure is also available in the chapter one of our guidance document. To give you a context, the smallest microplastic can be 1 nanometer, which is even smaller than a strand of a DNA. DNA is 2.5 nanometers. And then the largest microplastics can be up to 5 millimeter, less than 5 millimeters in size, which is about the size of a drinking straw. And in addition to size, microplastics also come in additional physical chemical properties. They can be made of different polymers. They can also have other additives, such as flame retardants. They can also come from different sources, which we will talk about that in more detail shortly. They can come in different shapes, colors. They can also absorb different toxicants from the environment, such as heavy metals. And this is another figure in our guidance document, which shows different sources and product types, different industries that could be sources of microplastics. And typically, microplastics are categorized either primary or secondary. And primary microplastics are the ones that are intentionally manufactured as microplastics to be used in specific products or applications. Some examples of primary microplastics include microbeads in personal care products or pre-production pellets. These are also known as nurdles that are used in plastic production of various plastic products. This is a case study which shows citizens picking up nurdles from the Gulf of Mexico from the beach due to a spill. And this type of data can play a significant role to drive litigation and ultimately impact policy. And the nurdles are an example of primary microplastic pollution in the environment. And you can find the details of this case study in the appendix of our guidance documents as well. And microplastics can also be secondary. So these are the type of microplastics that originate from the breakdown of larger plastics into smaller fragments, into smaller pieces over time due to exposure to sunlight, water erosion, wind, or microorganisms. And some examples include wear and tear of car tires, fragmentation of consumer products such as plastic water bottles or cigarette filters, as well as microfibers shedding from synthetic textiles. And this is another case study which shows, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, there has been an increase in the disposable personal protective equipment such as face masks and gloves, as well as the takeout food containers ended up as waste in the environment. Eventually, these plastic items going to break down into smaller pieces, which would be an example of secondary microplastic pollution in the environment. And again, you can find the details of this case study in our appendix of our guidance documents as well. As we mentioned, microplastics can also come in different shapes. They can come in as fragments, beads, pellets, filaments, fibers, and so on. And you can see in this picture, there have various colors and shapes. And there are some studies showing, depending on the shape of the microplastics that are made from the same polymer type and same size, the irregular shapes, such as fragments, are going to have a higher surface area to volume ratio compared to regular shapes, such as beads, which then make those irregular microplastics to have a higher chemical adsorption capacity. So then that can impact their toxicity endpoints. And another thing to keep in mind, there are organisms confuse microplastics with food in the environment depending on their size, shape, and color, and they selectively feed on those microplastics. Microplastics can also absorb harmful chemicals from the environment, such as heavy metals, such as lead or cadmium. They can also absorb persistent organic pollutants, also known as PAPs. Some examples of PAPs include PCBs, PFAS, DDT, and others. And there are several factors that can increase the chemical absorption capacity of microplastics. Microplastics are hydrophobic, they don't like water, and they will attract chemical contaminants from water bodies onto themselves, and they can move those as they move throughout the environment. And because of their small size, they have a high surface area to volume ratio, which increases their chemical absorption capacity. And as we just mentioned, rougher shapes and weather than age particles as well going to have higher surface area to volume ratio compared to regular shapes and virgin particles, which will increase their chemical absorption capacity. Polymer type is also another factor. Low density and rubbery plastics such as polyethylene or polypropylene are going to have a higher chemical absorption capacity compared to high density or glossy plastics such as PET or PVC. Microplastics can also act as vectors. They can allow formation of biofilms, which then makes them act as vectors for carrying bacterial pathogens. They can also spread antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They can move long distances to transport chemical contaminants throughout the environment. Therefore, they can be a source of contaminant in the aquatic environments, sediments, and biota. However, there's a debate between the researchers on the vector impacts of microplastics, so there are further studies needed to understand the vector effects of microplastics. And as we look at the publications coming in every year on the toxicity studies of microplastics in the bar chart here, especially after 2015, there has been an increase in both human health and ecological toxicity studies of microplastics. The human health is shown in the orange bars, and ecological studies shown with the gray bars here. So this is definitely a rapidly evolving state of science for microplastics, and microplastics are emerging contaminants of concern. They do contribute to the plastic pollution, which is already a problem. Because of their small size, they can be consumed by humans and other organisms, which can impact, which can cause adverse health impacts that are exposed to microplastics. And as we mentioned, microplastics have various physical chemical properties, which also makes them very challenging in terms of understanding their toxicity endpoints. And with that concludes our introduction section today. And now I'm going to turn it over to Alex McDonald to introduce an interactive case study. So this will be used throughout our training today. And thank you for your attention, Alex. Please take it over when you get a chance. Thank you.
That's really good information. Hope you guys are listening. I'm here to introduce a generic case study. And with this case study, we're going to be coming back to it several times during our training. And this is good. The goal of that is to help reinforce the things you've been learning all along. So let me get over to that case study. Okay. So what you see here, you look at the picture on the left-hand side of the screen. Think of this as something like San Francisco Bay or Chesapeake Bay, Seattle, Tacoma area as examples. And on this, we show various different man activities in the way and things that they do, such as farming. We have industrial processes. You see a wastewater treatment plant. You see a residential community. You see fishing. There's a landfill. And then we also show driving, and there's a beach scene down there. And that's the beach scene is basically to present man's outdoor activities. So, what we're going to do is we're going to have you identify the microplastic sources that you see in this figure. Just like you did in the very beginning, you're going to use the chat function, and I want you to put it, and you have 30 seconds to do so. So you guys can commence and put in what microplastic sources you see in that figure. Okay, go ahead. Tires, very good. Industry, fishing nets, umbrellas, wastewater plant, the discharges, the personal care products, effluent, home waste, fishing nets. Looks like you guys are getting most of them here. Stormwater, very good. Okay, you got 5 more seconds. Everywhere there are humans, lures and fishing line, agriculture, very good. Okay, you can stop putting in your answers, and let's take a look at what we came up with. So people got the roadway, got the tires, but the actual roadway itself can be a source of microplastics. Some states in like the island of Guam, they actually put ground up plastic bottles into their asphalt mix, which generates a much longer lifespan of the pavement itself. And also the paint on the pavement. Paint can be a good source of microplastics. Wastewater treatment plant, it's the source, but it's actually just passing along what's coming to it. Biosolids on the farm, don't remember seeing that one. Housing, the residential community, we got that. The factory, the fishing boat, landfill, car tires, and then beach use. Beach use is man's activities. People taking their Doritos bags and just dropping them on the ground or something like that. So you guys did a great job on looking at all this sort of thing. Someone actually put in the swimsuit. Very good. Most swimsuits are not made of cotton anymore or wool anymore. It's like they used to be. Okay. So next Next, I'm going to turn you over now to Judd Mahan of TRC, I mean Tetra Tech, and he's going to look through environmental distribution, fate, and transport.
Thanks, Alex. Yes, as Alex said, I'm a geologist with the consulting firm Tetra Tech. We're going to talk now about the distribution, fate, and transport of microplastics. As Dishley and Valerie earlier were mentioning, microplastics are ubiquitous in the environment now. I'm trying to make sure I've got control of the slides there. Yeah, I think I'm good. So even though they're ubiquitous, there is plenty to learn about the distribution, the fate, and transport. This illustration, it's the conceptual site model for microplastics that's used in the online guidance document. On the website, it's an interactive figure that's got pop-ups that provide information about various sources and mechanisms of microplastic transport. So for this set of slides, we're going to use the CSM as we talk through some examples. And you can also use the interactive CSM on the website to navigate through the online document. All right, so here we have some examples of point sources of microplastics. So we're talking about here discrete conveyances, stormwater or wastewater outfalls. Can be other things, smokestacks, for instance. Also, you can even have marine point sources where ocean-going vessels have materials that are lost or discharged or discarded overboard. Now, non-point sources, due to that ubiquitous nature of microplastics, these are especially problematic. And so this is where, generally you have broad areas or many sources at once that are distributing microplastics into the environment. Beaches are an example where litter might be spread along a beach and then it washes, or it could be transported by wind into other areas. Residential neighborhoods can be point sources as household products are used and discarded. Agricultural lands also microplastics can originate from things like fertilizer pellets, wastewater treatment plant biosolids that are used as soil amendments, even various other gardening materials, plastic sheeting, containers, etc. And then roadways. Trying to get that to pop up there. Roadways also non-point sources where tires are worn down and generate tire wear particles. Now, about the tire wear particles, these are generated from the friction between tires and the road surface. The particles are then deposited nearby in surface waters or soil. And so 6 PPD is an anti-ozonate. It's incorporated into the tires. And 6 PPD quinone is a byproduct, which has been linked to coho salmon mortality. Research here is ongoing to help understand why coho salmon are as susceptible as they are to the toxic effects of 6 PPD, and also to understand whether other aquatic organisms might be affected and to what degree. There's a lot more information on this case study in the guidance document. Now, how are microplastics generated? This has been touched on a little bit so far. We just mentioned tire wear, for instance. So microplastics, they're generated in a variety of ways, and both abiotic and biotic processes are involved. So chemical, physical, biological reactions. Now, the size distribution is a really important factor in the fate and transport with processes like biofouling, aggregation, time of residence. All of this affects the fate and transport and then hence the distribution. Photodegradation, that's really important as an initial process at the Earth's surface, but biodegradation becomes important also as microplastics are buried or move into the subsurface or into the deeper ocean, for instance. Now, streams and rivers play an important role with microplastics distribution. Physical properties are going to determine how the particles are transported, whether that's more quickly, more slowly. Heavier particles are more likely to be deposited in sinks, such as lakes and other areas where there's decreased flow velocity. Now, two-way transport is a significant factor to keep in mind. Microplastics can move from land to water to air and potentially cycle back through these media. Now, freshwater surface water systems receive microplastics from a variety of sources. So that's including atmospheric deposition, groundwater infiltration, stormwater discharges, wastewater. Rivers, these are important transport corridors and move microplastics from upland areas to bays, to estuaries, which are home to many organisms that are food sources. Mussels, crustaceans, other deposit feeders can ingest microplastics. One of the concerns that arises here is that microplastics can also alter things like nutrient cycling and could contribute to things like an increase in ammonium, which is associated with red tides. Now, wastewater treatment plants, industrial and municipal, are some of the primary sources contributing microplastics to surface waters. Now, microplastics from wastewater, they're sourced from both industrial and domestic products. Now, as we all know, products, there's a great variety out there. Microplastics are generated both during the manufacture as well as the use of products. Treatment plant processes, they have been shown to successfully to be able to successfully remove microplastics. However, there's a lack of standard treatments and analysis methods, and this can limit the efficiency of the microplastics removal. Many treatment plants process biosolids for land application, and so that can lead to a re-release of plastics to the environment. Studies are showing that microplastics that are sourced from wastewater treatment plants, those often occur as fibers, and they tend to be of a relatively smaller size range, generally less than half of a millimeter. Now, groundwater, this can be a surprise, but the limited data that's available does show that microplastics occur in groundwater, although maybe at a lower prevalence than in other media. Most environmental monitoring wells are constructed of plastic. So right off the bat, we've got an obstacle to sampling and analysis. Again, the movement is affected by particle size and density. Other factors are also important, so pH, salinity. And as with so many environmental contaminants, preferential pathways can aid transport. Some studies have shown that microplastics are occurring in groundwater in locations such as Illinois in the United States, Germany, South Africa. But as research continues, we would expect to have more geographic locations that are reporting microplastics in groundwater. Now, for the oceans, plastic pollution in the oceans has certainly got a lot of attention in the public media over the years, and there's a lot of information out there now available about this. This slide, it just touches on some of the concepts that are involved. So microplastics are entering the oceans by multiple routes. We mentioned rivers, outfalls, the atmosphere. They tend to move at the ocean surface towards slower moving oceanic gyres. Denser plastics are going to tend to sink. They're reported from all depths. Floating debris, it's moved in the oceans by various mechanisms. Some of these ocean currents, convergence zones, as well as Stokes drift, which has to do with transport by wave action, and Langmuir circulation, which has to do with the wind interacting with the ocean surface. As we mentioned with fluvial environments, vertical transport factors can include degradation, aggregation, biofouling, and then also you have the varying buoyancy of different plastic materials. All of these are factors. Now, soils are likely to be long-term sinks for microplastics since most plastic is used on land. We see higher abundances near roads and areas where just, there's a lot of plastics that are being used or processed. That can include waste management facilities, the agricultural areas that I mentioned, home gardens, even. Plastics have the potential to alter soil properties, and so they can have effects on the bulk density, the water retention capacity of soil. Research is showing here that plastic fibers can have distinctly negative effects compared to other forms of plastic. Now, as microplastics settle from the water column, they combine with sediments. This happens with marine and freshwater, flowing, non-flowing water. As we've touched on, the denser plastics, they're going to tend to sink and be deposited. Research indicates that sediments that have a higher total organic carbon content, they also tend to have more microplastics. Residence time in sediments can be really high, especially in low flow conditions. And again, resuspension and redistribution, are factors to be aware of. Now, the atmospheric occurrence of microplastics in the air, like groundwater, this can be a little bit of a surprise. It's more common in urban and industrial settings. Deposition can then occur with precipitation events. It turns out that microplastics are an emerging component of air pollution, and plastics can combine with other air pollutants. Desley mentioned some of those factors earlier. Transport here, it varies with atmospheric factors such as wind speed, up and down drafts. No surprise, though, the atmospheric occurrence, it tends to be those smaller microplastic particle sizes, but here we're talking about all of the various different shapes. Now, urban litter, larger plastic waste, it breaks down into microplastics. It turns out that the plastic portion of litter can really vary dramatically from place to place. A study in the San Francisco Bay Area showed that 2 to 15% of litter by volume was plastic, whereas a study for the Mississippi River Basin showed plastic making up to as much as 74% of litter. Storm events are going to play a big role in the transport. A study in Los Angeles indicated that microplastics increased by sevenfold at the coast near Long Beach after a storm. And then similarly, a study at the Great Lakes showed that all forms of microplastics, from fragments to films, pellets, increased in concentrations as a result of precipitation events. Now, the occurrence of microplastics in living organisms is also getting a lot of attention. Some of you mentioned in the chat, things like microplastics showing up in human blood, in various tissues in our bodies, from plants to invertebrates, mammals. It spans all levels of the food web. Research clearly shows that microplastics are being ingested. But more studies are needed to determine the effects. With plants, studies do show uptake by crops through roots, with transport to shoots and fruits such as tomatoes. Some organisms can be particularly vulnerable. So filter feeders, they're at risk due to that suspension feeding on particulate matter. And other marine life, such as fish and macroinvertebrates, also ingesting microplastics. All right, so that's an overview of the distribution, the fate and transport. There's a lot more detail, as well as good references that are available in the guidance documents. I'm going to hand it back over to Alex now in the interactive case study.
Thanks, Judd. Let's make sure that my slides are working. Okay. So, hope you guys are paying attention to Judd there, because this time we're going to ask. I have two polls we're going to go through here. The first is going to be on. We're going to look at impacted media. So we looked at before. We saw what the sources were. Now we're going to identify what impacted media did those sources happen to influence. So take a look at the slide here. Got 30 seconds again, so you can begin now and start putting those answers in the chat. What media do you see? Fish, okay.
Air, water, soil, set. Oh, that's what, try to get them all. Groundwater, surface, air, water, soil, surface water, soil, crops, groundwater. Looks like we're getting almost all of them. Everyone's getting source water. Human beings, good one. Sediment. Birds. Benthic organisms. Okay, it's got 2 seconds here. Very good. Beach sand. All right, someone got the beach sand one. Very good. Okay, let's see what the answers we have. Ambient air. Obviously, Judd made that point very important announcement that ambient air is a big source of microplastics being blown around in the air. In fact, it's probably one of the biggest human exposures is to microplastics in ambient air. Subsurface and surface soils. When we said soils, we got that. Most people got that one. Surface water. I think everyone got surface water. Groundwater got mentioned once or twice. Beach sand, which I'm surprised because a lot of people don't get the beach sand one. It's kind of hidden there. Crops and produce. So the farming activities, you're putting in the crops and plants. Very good job. Very good job. So we have one more for you to do. So we've gone through now transport mechanism. Okay, we've gone through basically the sources, what impact and media is there. Now we're going to say how were those people from the sources to the impacted media, how did it get there? So the next slide we're going to show here, I want you to go through and look at the transport pathways. What transport pathways do you envision happening on the slide to get that microplastic to those receptors? Very good. I started already. All right. Very good. Runoff, rivers, wind dispersion, wastewater, river, atmospheric distribution. Very good. Runoffs, rain, air, convection, wind, precipitation, rain. Oh, someone tried to quit all of them in at one time. Very good. Runoff, roads. All right. Very good. Direct disposal. All right. Very good. We'll get to the answers here. So, what do you see? Urban runoff. Everyone's only got urban. So, there's two types of runoff here. Urban runoff, which is occurring during non-stormwater events. So, urban runoff will transport stuff, washing down things down driveways and whatnot into the creek. Very good. Rainfall is going to move it down into under the ground, where it's going to be transported via surface water streams to the larger body of water. That's what's stormwater discharge. Air emissions from the factory. That's another transportation method. You got it up into the air. Wind-blown waste from the say examples, the landfill. It's going to have it coming out. Wastewater discharges. We got that one. Agricultural soil disturbance. So, if people recall that, hey. Land application of biosolids from this wastewater treatment plant over here onto this farmland, that can be a major source of microplastics. Quite a bit of the microplastics fall out within the biosolids that's collected by the wastewater treatment plant, and we use it on put on food crops. So erosion, wind erosion, water, surface water erosion from those fields was going to place it into the surface water. One we kind of didn't touch on here, I have an arrow. You look over at the fishing vessel. There's an arrow coming off of it. Why is that? Almost all fishing nets are made of plastic nowadays. So abrasion by taking this net in and out of the fishing vessel, plus if it drags along the bottom, which some do, that's going to scrape off my plastic and a little bit of microplastic into the environment. So that's it. That's one we haven't really, I don't think we it got mentioned in our so far in our training, but another one to keep aware, be aware of. So that wraps up three of our four different quizzes here. And hopefully you find these interesting and has gotten get those little brain cells moving. So next I'm going to turn this over to Elia Enright from TRC, and she's going to discuss sampling and analysis.
Thank you, Alex. So here's a summary of what we'll cover in this section. First, we'll talk about considerations for selecting appropriate methods for both sampling and analysis. We'll cover the ITRC tools that we had developed to help you choose appropriate methods. One is for sampling and one is for analysis. We'll talk about standard and adopted methods available and the important step of minimizing sample contamination. So we return once again to our conceptual site model, this time with sampling and analysis in mind. So once again, if you click on the various locations, you will get links to the various sections within the guidance document on the various media. And oops, so each of the media here has a subsection on both sample collection methods and sample preparation and analysis methods. So before we jump into the tools that we developed to help select specific methods for sample microplastic sample collection and analysis, we want to step back and think about what are your data quality objectives. And this is a really important consideration. A number of the considerations are shown here, things like sample media type, particle size, minimum detectable amounts that you're interested in, what kind of data you need, is it size, polymer, units, shape, etc., and then what equipment and cost you have available. And the reason this is a really important step is because different methods are able to provide different data and some have limitations. So, for example, certain sampling methods can only collect microplastics down to a certain size range, and certain analytical methods may not be able to provide information on characteristics such as polymer types or shapes. So those criteria are important to you. You want to make sure you utilize methods that can provide that data. All right. So that brings us to our first, there we go. Our first tool, which is the online sample collection matrix. So it's an online matrix that is filterable. So you can filter by media, as shown here, and you can also filter by particle size range. And so as you can see here, we collect or select wastewater and all size fractions. And once you select those, you can scroll down and see what methods are available for those inputs. And the tool provides the best fit for these criteria, and you can also change the parameters to see how results would change. And the table also provides details like particle size range, sample type and description, what equipment would be needed, advantages and disadvantages, and relative cost. So the methods shown in that online matrix tool are methods described in the literature, but due to the evolving nature of our understanding of microplastics, there are very few standardized sampling methods. However, there are a few for water matrices. These include an ASTM standard for a variety of water types and a California Water Board's method specific for drinking water. Both of these methods use a similar concept of volumetric reduction, in which a large volume of water is run through a series of sieves to provide a more representative sample than a smaller volume grab sample. And the first method here is different from the second in that the second option provides or outlines the use of inline sieve filtration, which is intended to reduce the possibility of contamination from ambient air. Now, to select the appropriate analytical procedures to characterize your microplastic samples, we developed Table 3.1. This is just an excerpt of that table, it's not the complete table. So for look at the complete table, go to the guidance document. This table shown here shows that, similar to the sampling matrix, there are a variety of methods and capabilities that vary between the different methods. So, to help you decide which method is the most appropriate for your project, please take a look at this table and consider all the inputs and outputs that you need for your project. And then, similar to the sampling methods, there are very few methods that are adopted, but the state of California has adopted specifically two methods, FTIR and Raymond methods, for drinking water samples, as shown here. So As we heard from the previous presenters, plastics are used for innumerable products in our modern world. Because of this, it is very important to both minimize and account for potential contamination of your samples throughout the process of both sampling and analysis. So, at a high level, to minimize contamination, you should eliminate or limit plastic products used in these various processes as much as possible, and instead of a clean laboratory. However, we can't expect to completely eliminate contamination, so we should collect various blanks to quantify potential contamination. This figure 3.2 is from the guidance document, and it outlines some of the considerations an example commercial laboratory implemented in their microplastics lab to make a clean lab. So these components are aluminum ceiling tiles, a dedicated custom designed gowning room with an airlock, and that gowning room has separate HVAC from both the inner lab, the airlock, and the outer hallway. And there's pressure triggers when a technician moves between the rooms to prevent airflow between them. There's also a rigorous water filtration system, and the room is cleaned twice daily with a HEPA filtered vacuum. So, in summary, sampling and analysis methods for microplastics are continuously evolving and being evaluated. There are two standard sampling methods for water, as we discussed, and the FTIR and Raman analytical methods were adopted for drinking water in California. For other media and scenarios, please use our ITRC tools to help select methods for your specific project. And while you're planning out your sampling program, make sure to minimize and account for contamination. That, we will pause for a question and answer break.
All right, thanks, Aaliyah. And as she mentioned, we are at our first question and answer break of the training. We will have one more opportunity at the end of the training to answer your questions live. But I do see a few open questions in the chat for our trainers. First one, is there any data on what percentage of microplastic pollution is from primary versus secondary sources?
I can go ahead and take that one, Taylor. So while we don't have the exact percentage difference between it, secondary microplastics are significantly more abundant than primary microplastics. Secondary microplastics are continuously being formed as products break down. Most of what we have in our oceans is secondary microplastics versus those primary microplastics like plastic beads and nurdles, which are used to create macroplastics, are less out in the environment than those primary micro or than those secondary microplastics. So while I don't know the percentage, it's certainly more primary and or I'm sorry, certainly more secondary. And the primary is just going to continue to break down and form secondary, since it's such a wide range of things that create microplastics from that 1 nanometer all the way up to the 5 micrometers.
I want to add something. This is Yasmin, and there are roughly, I can give some kind of percentages regarding secondary versus primary microplastics. And Valerie is absolutely correct. It is almost 80% of the total microplastic generates from the secondary microplastics. So 80% secondary microplastics, roughly, and 20% primary microplastics. And another thing that I want to add, this confirmed what we found from the recent hospitality study that we performed. It was almost very close to that finding. So.
Thanks, Valerie. Thanks, Yasmin. Another question we have. A recent study highlighted methodological challenges, sorry, that can produce false positives when detecting microplastics in human blood. What specific contamination controls and analytical validation steps do you recommend to distinguish true and endogenous particles from laboratory or environmental contamination? And the second part of that, and how does that impact the current stats we already have on microplastic levels in the bloodstream? Let me know if anyone needs me to repeat that.
Yeah, I can comment on the first part. So, I've read the articles you're talking about. Excuse me. There is a standard method that has been published since this guidance document, this microplastics guidance document we developed through ITRC. So we don't comment on it in this document, but it's ISO 24187. And it's called Principles for the Analysis of Microplastics Present in the Environment. And that is an international standard of sampling protocols and analytical protocols for microplastics. So I believe in that I haven't been able to obtain a copy of that, but you could purchase that and see what kinds of quality assurance samples specifically are recommended in there. And that would kind of be like the gold standard of QAQC analysis. And so yes, I think especially with human and tissue samples is the that is a bit more complex than like the water samples that a lot of our research has been done on. So I think for the second part of the question about how does that affect our understanding of different discoveries? I don't know, Valerie, if you wanted to jump in, if that's why your video is on. I think Usha might also have some insights.
I was going to comment, but I won't say too much. I'll let Usha say something as well. And Usha is about to give us the human health portion of the training, and so some of that I think will come out in the training that she does talk about. I think the one thing I do want to say is this paper came out recently to and sheds a lot of doubt on some of the information that was previously identified as microplastics in human tissues. And I do want to state that there is overwhelming evidence that there are microplastics in human tissues. A lot of there's accuracy in those papers that early studies didn't do as good of a job at having the proper controls in place, and there likely is contamination, and maybe the numbers that came out from those studies, some of the early studies aren't exactly correct. But that doesn't mean that we don't still have microplastics in human tissues and that there isn't things that we need to be doing to reduce microplastics. So I just think that's an important caveat as we read those papers and we think about moving forward, to not think that our current understanding is incorrect because we might not have the exact numbers. But with that, I'll let Usha add something. And then again, I think she'll get into it more in her section.
I cannot read the question. It's not showing up on my panel. Can you just read out that question for me?
Yeah, did you want the whole question?
Yeah, no, not the one about the methodological challenges. I think that's already been answered, but whatever piece it is that Valerie thought I might want to add on to, I can't see the text for some reason. If you can read out that question.
Usha, it's essentially the article you had been emailing about how does the potential false positives affect what we
Oh, okay.
are
Yeah.
understanding.
Really, the short answer, it will be addressed more in the section coming up, but the short answer is in terms of effects, you need to understand. In order to understand what the risks are for health, you need to understand how much exposure we have and what the toxicity is related to that level of exposure. And even though this study is Really, all the study is doing is it's highlighting the uncertainties in quantifying how much exposure we have. It's not really saying there is no exposure. It's just saying there's a lot of uncertainty in understanding how much might be in our tissues. And then on the other side of the equation, there's still also uncertainty in quantifying how much exposure leads to what kind of effect. And so it's not really a bombshell study as it's been, marketed, so to speak, in the media. It's really just pointing out that there is still a lot we don't know. But as Valerie said, there is no doubt that microplastics are present in tissues. The question is how much confidence we have in how much there is. And then at the same time, we're also still studying what the toxicity is and the mechanisms of toxicity. So I'll cover that more in the next session.
And I guess one thing to add to that is it was a good quote from a response to that article by Sarah McHugh. It was her quote was calling for greater scientific precision should never serve as an excuse for inaction. Rather, it should strengthen the resolve to generate undeniable evidence that supports a transition away from a plastic-dependent economy. So I think that's, just another way of saying what Usha was saying. It doesn't dismiss it, might need to be refined a bit more, but doesn't throw out all of the findings that have happened to date.
It's really just a scientific process. It's not just for microplastics, it's for any emerging chemical. It takes a while to get to a point of high confidence in our measurements.
All right, thanks, Aaliyah, Valerie, and Usha. And since that was a good question to segue into our next section, we will have one more opportunity, like I mentioned, to answer questions live at the end of this training, but please continue to use that Q&A pod to ask your questions, and we will be monitoring it throughout the rest of the training. So I'm now going to turn it over to Usha to continue with human health and ecological risk.
Okay, let me see if I can get my slides. Okay. Okay, well, so I'm going to start with human health and then proceed to ecological receptors today. I'm going to cover what we know and what we don't know about exposure and health effects related to microplastics. I'm going to go over some available tools for toxicity evaluation. A key point here is that we are referring to health effects related to microplastics. So just keep in mind that we're not talking about macroplastics. We're not talking about masses of plastic bags in the stomachs of whales and so on. This is about particles, much smaller than that. So, okay. And under the human health and receptor categories, I'm going to talk about a little bit about exposure, a little bit about effects, and a little bit about the uncertainties. So, as I believe this was shown in Deeshley's slides as well, to understand the potential health effects of any substance, we need to have information on exposure and also on whether or not it's hazardous to health and what is the nature of that hazard. So for this level of information, it is critically important to have sufficient toxicity information where the data quality is acceptable. That's just really important. And the available toxicity information for microplastics, it follows the typical trend that we see for any kind of emerging chemicals, where in the beginning you'll have very few studies, very little information, and then there'll be a quick big increase in the rate of studies being published. And for microplastics, there's been a big increase from the 1990s to current years. So there's a lot of work going on. And when it comes to human health exposures, there's multiple media and multiple pathways for human exposure to microplastics. And the exposure, it varies by where we live, and to some degree, our lifestyles. And this slide, which is based on the work we did up to the time of the guidance publication, it shows inhalation is outweighing dietary ingestion in terms of the magnitude of human exposure to microplastics. But actually, since then, there's been more studies showing that there are local and regional differences. And like Judd was saying earlier, that in urban and industrial areas, typically you can see more microplastics in air than in other areas. And so now there are also studies that show that inhalation exposures may be greater in urban areas, but dietary ingestion related exposures may be greater in other areas. And so it just depends on certain environmental factors in terms of how much we are exposed to. But in general, inhalation and ingestion exposures outweigh exposures related to dermal contact. So now in terms of understanding the toxicity of microplastics, so we've mentioned right from the beginning that microplastics isn't just one kind of particle or one kind of size. It is so variable in terms of what the chemical composition of the particles is, what their sizes are, even their shapes and their their behavior in the environment. Do they sink? Do they swim in the water? That kind of thing. And because of all of this, it actually makes toxicity research on microplastics a really complicated issue. And when we look at the toxicity literature, there's a lot of uncertainties in the study design that can be related back to, do we know exactly what exposure concentration they used or they were measuring? What's the quality of the data? Are they reporting everything that we would need to know? What are the data gaps? So these six boxes in that figure on the right, they show some of the challenges associated with doing tox research on microplastics. And one key thing to remember when we think about this in a risk assessment framework is just being exposed to something doesn't automatically mean that there's going to be an adverse health effect associated with it. The whole premise of dose response assessment is that we are trying to get beyond that documentation of exposure to something that's a more predictable relationship between how much exposure and what kind of exposure might lead to what kind of health effect. So all of this just goes to show that microplastics toxicity research is very, very active right now, and there's a lot more that we need to know. So Coffin et al., I think it was in 2022, they published a study where they did a sort of a literature review of the not just the toxicity information itself, but just the quality of the toxicity studies that were available at that time regarding microplastics toxicity. And they came up with these bars that showed 26 test quality criteria that ideally you would want the studies to meet these criteria before you can say, there's a really good tox study. I'm going to take the information from this and use it to develop regulatory thresholds or whatever. And among these, the red ones, the red bars are considered the minimum test quality criteria that need to be met. And the green ones are the ones that would be nice to have. And if you look at the x-axis on the bottom, you can see how many studies met all of these criteria. And at that time, there were very few studies that met all of them. And again, it just means that again, we need to know more. And so at this time, this is the best that we can do as of 2022. Since then, of course, as I'm saying, there's a lot more studies. But having said this, some of the toxicity endpoints for human health in particular, they did try to come up with some estimation of trends. And when we say human toxicity, in fact, keep in mind that most of the studies, they are mammalian studies, but really they're based on rodents. rat, mouse, and so on. There are really no studies that I know of where they've done reliable dose response assessment using human toxicity data. So here, some of the most commonly reported health effects for humans include female reproductive effects, male reproductive effects, effects on the liver, and some effects on general systemic and organismal effects. And so it is that there's a wider range of effects that have been reported since then, and many of them include information from on cellular level responses and metabolic responses in mouse studies. There's correlations from epidemiological studies, and so a wide range of the effects that are considered possible now includes oxidative stress, DNA damage, inflammation, immune responses, and neurotoxicity. And these are initial reports, and really we need more work to carry it to the next level of reliability and certainty. Now, when it comes to ecological toxicity, there's actually a lot more studies just because it's easier, to test fish or invertebrates for toxic effects than it is to test humans. And so this just shows you the wealth of data that's available as of a couple of years ago. And it just shows you that some of these groups, like fish studies and molluscan studies, you have a lot more than you have million studies and so on. So to talk about aquatic toxicity as an example, there are three ways actually that microplastics can exert toxicity. And this applies to humans as well as ecological organisms. One is physical, which is the toxicity that can be exerted just by the nature of by the particles themselves. Think of it like asthma or something. You have something in the air you're breathing. Just the fact that you're breathing in particles can cause some kind of a toxic effect. Then the other kind of toxicity is chemical, which is what is a particle made of? And is it made of chemicals that are particularly hazardous in some way? There's a third type of toxicity actually for microplastics, which is when they serve as vectors for pathogens. So if you have particles going through a wastewater treatment system and they're still coming out and there's viruses and bacteria riding along and they're released into the environment, then you can have pathogenic effects as well. But today, I'm not going to cover the chemical and the pathogenic because you can really kind of evaluate it based on existing information in the literature. What's more unique about microplastics is the mechanical toxicity associated with the particles themselves. And here, it really matters what the particle size is. The other thing that matters is the shape of the particle. But let's first talk about the size of the particle. So the smaller the particle, which is as you go to the left-hand side of this little graphic, the more those particles are so small that they can penetrate really deep into the tissues. They can even cross barriers, membranes and cellular barriers. And so the kind of damage that you can see, it can be at the cellular level. So there can be inflammation responses, there can be oxidative stress reactions, and there can be neurological effects. On the right side, as the particles get larger, then you can have physical damage, like it just gets into the gut of a fish, for example, and sits there. And it's a particle that is occupying space in the gut, but it has no nutritional value. So you can have food dilution, you can have gastrointestinal obstruction, and we can have irritation and injury. And so what it really shows is that there is a whole range of effects that can be experienced by the organism depending
depending on the size of the particle. There's actually even shape and shape-related effects. So if you have a very irregular particle with sharp edges, they have noticed that that can cause more inflammation and physical injury to the tissues. And a lot of the research right now is focused on the studies that report them. They'll use like one single size of spherical particles, for example, for their testing. And nothing wrong with that. But what it doesn't capture is other kinds of particles. And so for fibers in particular, the toxicology research right now is very understudied. But similar to asbestos, the longer, skinnier fibers can often penetrate really deep into tissues, and we still don't know enough about what kind of toxicity might be associated with that. So here is some information in particular for the cellular damage. And the thing I want to highlight here is how the particles, the smaller they are, have the ability to translocate within the tissue. So they may come in through ingestion, but then they could really go really far out and end up in some other parts of the body. And the last thing, interesting thing on the nutritional deficiencies is that sometimes fish and aquatic invertebrates, they can preferentially consume the microplastics particles. Based on the size and the shape and the color, they can think that it's food. And so they go after it and they eat it on purpose. But then, of course, it turns out that it has no value and could actually cause some toxicity. So there's a world of information out there. How do we try to get a handle on all of it? There is program that's been developed in association with the Southern California Coastal Water Research Program. It's called TOMEX, Toxicity Microplastics Explorer. And if you use this tool, it's a really nice, easy-to-use tool. They have compiled information on toxicity, and it's just so nice, nicely set up in terms of you can find the information that you want from whatever is available there. It also allows you to visualize and do various kinds of plots and graphs to get a better handle on what the data show and the interpretation. So that is worth checking out if you are more interested in this. So the last topic is, okay, with all this information on exposure and toxicity, what we really want to know with the risk-based approach is what is safe and what is not safe. You know, how much level of microplastics can we tolerate, and then what do we do about it? And at this time, there are no universal risk-based thresholds that have any regulatory significance. But people are trying to come up with something. And again, SQIRP in California tried to, along with people from the water resource, from the water boards, did some initial work where they took available aquatic toxicity information and they tried to come up with these numeric categories of what number of particles per liter in water, or sometimes they look at mass, you know, micrograms of microplastics per liter in water, corresponded to different levels of adverse effects. And they came up with five tiers, ranging from no concern to tier five, highest concern. And then they tried to come up with actionable items associated with those five tiers. And on the right side, they took data that had been collected for this Bay Area by the San Francisco Estuary Institute, and they tried to correlate their five tiers with the data that was actually collected. And if you see the red triangles, those are the areas that met tier five. And those are located in the south most southern end of the San Francisco Bay, where there is the least mixing of water. And so that is where they found the highest concentrations and the highest potential for adverse effects to the aquatic community. And then as you went more out into the open water, there was a lot more dilution. And so there it was more in the tier one to tier two levels. And okay, let me. I have a couple more things to say. So these are numeric levels at this point, but they were developed only for the purpose of sort of establishing a protocol. They have no regulatory significance at this time, and you can actually go to their website and find these numbers, but they have not been, they are still working on improving those numbers to get to a higher level of confidence and robustness. And so it just, it's still an ongoing process. And so be aware that these are not final numbers at this time. So if you go to Appendix A2 in our guidance document, there is a really cool case study there that looks at the consequences of microplastics on in Chesapeake Bay, where they tried to look at the specific effects on ecological endpoints, and that's an interesting study to look at. And so in summary, for the health effects, there's these physical, chemical, and biological hazards associated with microplastics. As like we were just talking about for the earlier study that Alia and I were discussing, exposure characterization, it's really highly uncertain, but it doesn't mean the exposure is not happening. It's just a matter of how do we quantify it, to a better and better level of confidence. And adverse outcome pathway information is still needed. And as always, we always need to know more about toxicity, not just the effects, but the mechanisms of toxicity and how it happens. So we still have a lot to learn, but like any other emerging chemical, I would say every 2 to 3 years, we know a lot more than we used to know. And so we're still on that path. And with that, I am going to turn this over to Alex for the next case study.
Hey, Susha. So you're looking at our last poll. We've gone through sources of microplastics, media exposure, and transport of those microplastics. So last we're looking at who are the human and the ecological receptors. So we're going to do the same thing we've been doing. You're going to look at the slide. You're going to come up with what receptors do you see in this figure. You have 3 seconds, and we're beginning already. Fish, everyone's getting the fish. Everyone's getting aquatic. Air, air is not really a human or ecological exposure. Drinking water, humans. There we go. Aquatic invertebrates, fish, birds. Looks like we're getting all those. Crops, very good. Produce, water, wildlife. Very livestock. I think we've gotten them all in some more manner. Okay, you can stop what you're doing. We're going to take a look at what our answers are. So here, if you look closely, we have two columns. One column is human exposures, and others are ecological receptors. So you see that one probably most of the people think the beach swimmer. Well, I'm a swimmer, so that's one I'm going to remember first. Beach users, bay swimmer. The users, the agricultural worker, can't forget them. How about the people that are working in the landfill or in the industrial facility or living in the homes, all having exposures to microplastics due to the products they use, the products they make, or the trash that's coming into the landfill. Local anglers, yes, they're going to be potentially consuming those fish that are being exposed. All the aquatic receptors. All the animals you see in this figure, they're all being exposed at one point or another. Produce and crop consumers, we got those, I think, already. Vegetation, the last one, I don't think we even mentioned, so I would have been surprised if someone would have gotten soil and vertebrates. If you remember,
microplastics move through the soil column and invertebrates can be exposed. All right, very good. That's a great job. So let me go to the next slide. So what we've generated all this information. We've given you where it is in the environment, how it's moving through the environment, who's being exposed, and what media is being impacted by these microplastics. So what can you do? The next steps, just like you would do in any site investigation that you're looking at, you're going to have to develop the site conceptual model. And we've given you all the information to give you a generic one, a draft one to start with. So you take that information, massage it for your particular site, and from that conceptual site model, you'll be able to develop a sampling analysis plan, which is the normal process you would go with any pollutant out here. So depending on your site, your sources, what questions you're going to try to answer, you can come up with your site conceptual model and develop the sample analysis plan. So with that, you think you've gotten rid of me, but no such luck. I'm going to be coming in and I'm going to be doing regulatory context for you guys. So strap on. We're going to do some deep dive or sort of a deep dive into the regulatory world of microplastics. So back in 2021, when we first formed our really new team, new and forming our microplastics team, ITRC surveyed the states about the regulatory actions that to address microplastics. This slide highlights some of the most significant results from the 25 states that who responded. And for if you want additional details about the survey results, you can take a look at section 6.1 of our guidance document. So if you look closely here, one of the questions we had was sampling for microplastics. If you look closely, only California, the states in green there, California, Texas, and New Jersey reported that their states had sampled for microplastics in the environment. Doesn't mean that other states hadn't required maybe responsible parties or somebody else to sample, but actually conducting the sampling themselves. But if you look closely then at the next figure down there, how many have taken established regulatory criteria for microplastics? Well, no states have done that. However, two states, Pennsylvania and California, indicated that they are looking into the possibility of doing so. You got to remember, this is back in 2021 that these results came in. So there could be some changes along the way. There might be more states that actually are doing these types of activities on microplastics. Six others reported that they might do so in the future, look at establishing criteria. So states have taken various regulatory actions to tackle macroplastics, the big pieces in general, and this slide provides some examples. The most typical kinds of actions taken by states are things like recycling mandates and phasing out single-use plastic bags, phasing out restaurant utensils and food packaging. Notably, if you look closely, there are some states have actually banned the implementation of those kind of actions by their local governments. So more information we're going to about on the state actions and focus on microplastics can be found in Appendix C of our guidance document, which I'll be describing in the next few slides. Appendix C of the outline of our online guidance document includes detailed summaries of state, federal, and international efforts to address plastic pollution, not just microplastics, but also macroplastics. This appendix is in the form of an Excel spreadsheet with a tab for state and international statutory and regulations that focus on various kinds of microplastics pollution. The federal tab includes federal statutes like the Clean Water Act and the Marine Debris Act, as well as bills passed by Congress that authorize plastic pollution reduction efforts. As an example of that, the 2021's Save Our Seas 2.0 bills that got passed through Congress. There are two other tabs on the list on our table there. One that lists the acronyms and abbreviations that are used in the summaries And of course, this is a obligatory rule. There are a lot of acronyms, so it's probably good to have that table for you guys to look at. And the other summarizes state actions targeted towards macroplastics. So there's actually a special list there for macroplastics. You see those on the bottom of the screen. So we've got a blow up of a portion of the Excel spreadsheet that talks about regulatory criteria. So the state regulatory context provided through a summary table, that's what we're talking about here, which lists all the states and highlights whether or not they have requirements in place that are focused on addressing plastics and microplastics. These requirements are briefly described. See, there's a column for description of what it is. And web links, far right column, where you can actually access these various bills, regulations that have been adopted, or even just things that they're doing. For example, the summary includes Connecticut's 2021 House Bill number 5360, which established a working group of representatives from both the retail and apparel industry and the environmental community to focus on synthetic microfiber pollution. This working group focuses on developing consumer awareness, education programs in order to present information regarding synthetic microfibers in the clothing to the public. And there's a website you can actually go and see what they're doing. And the second example, below that, is one example of an Illinois prohibition of the manufacturing and sale of any non-drug personal care product that contains synthetic plastic microbeads by 2018 and 2019, respectively. This law also prohibits the manufacture for sale of any over-the-counter drug that contains synthetic plastic microbead by 2019 and 2020, respectively. Similar table, this one see here, is one of the various countries, and there's a number of different countries that have done something, and we'll discuss one of those in just the next slide coming up here. So here's an example of the European Union, and it's one of its efforts. It starts in 2019, the very top of the flow chart there, with a proposal by ECHA, ECHA, which is the European Chemicals Agency, to restrict intentionally added microplastics to consumer and professional products. The Risk Assessment Committee supports the proposal in 2020, that's the blue box, and recommends lowering the limit on particle size. Then REACH, which is the Registration, Evaluation, Authorization, and Restriction of Chemicals Committee, votes in favor of the proposal in 2023, and the Commission adopts measures to restrict intentionally added microplastics in September of 2023. So it's not a quick process, obviously 4 years or so to get there, but at least they're doing something. We'll give you a second example. We have a case study in our document, and it's basically the one in California's approach to addressing microplastic. This case study was included to provide a closer look at the key components of one state's microplastic program. So if you look on the left-hand side, we have Senate Bill 1422, and that's basically focused on drinking water, included a definition of microplastics and a standard method applicable to testing for microplastics in drinking water. It also included a 4-year drinking water testing and reporting program, including public disclosure of those results. And a policy handbook was issued in September 2022 to help implement the 4-year testing effort. The first 2 years of the monitoring results will be followed by 6 months of evaluation, which will be included in figuring out whether more sophisticated test methods are needed. So if you look at the timing, all this should have been pretty much completed by now, or is in the process of being completed this year with the 4 years of monitoring. So if you want to look at the results, go to California, look at the California State California Water Quality Control Board and or the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment web pages, and they can probably give you some of these results. But I would go to the water board's one first. So the second bill that was adopted was 1263, and it committed the state to developing and implementing a statewide microplastic strategy. This strategy was issued in February of 2022 and provides a multi-year roadmap identifying specific actions that the state planned to take. So, as I said before, all this came out prior to or just during our implementation or issuing of our guidance document. We say, what's going on since then? Well, we have a couple of slides that give you some ideas of what have actions that have taken place since 2022. First, there's been the introduction of Microplastic Safety Act by HR Human Resources, let's say the Senate federal actions. Basically, the Senate has drafted this bill to look at introduction of a safety act, evaluation of safety of microplastics. So they're going to conduct a study and report to the human health impacts of exposure to microplastics. And the second one on the list, you see, is the Public Health Research Act 4903. It's expanding federal programs related to plastic exposure, health research, and other purposes. In other words, putting more money into actually evaluating what's going on with microplastics and impacts on human health. So there's a few states that have actually taken some action already, and there's many more are in the process of looking into doing so. And the last one, there's other recent trends. Let's say it looks like a congressional report was published on March 2025 and examines global and U.S. Plastic production, use, and disposal statistics, and discusses contamination of oceans and freshwater by microplastics. Then NOAA and its Marine Debris Program, which is the United States government's lead for addressing the impacts of marine debris on our in oceans and waterways and the Great Lakes. And then basically, it discusses the program is conducting research on microplastics and associated impacts on aquatic ecosystems. And I already discussed the last one there. We already discussed that a few slides ago. So now you're done with me, and I'm going to be turning you over to Yasmin Kanuku of the WSP, and she's going to be talking about mitigation and abatement.
Thank you, Alex, for the overview of the current regulations about microplastic. I will now be covering the mitigation and abatement section from our guidance document. During the first part of the presentation, I will be talking about prevention and mitigation. About microplastics to reduce microplastics from entering the environment. The second half, we will focus on some technologies to abate, treat, and remediate microplastics, whether in drinking water, surface water, groundwater, marine environments, wastewater, soil, and air. Sorry. In order to keep as much as material out of landfill as possible, it is important for each of us to do our part. One of the ways to put this plan into action is to apply a waste management hierarchy as guidance for managing plastics. The United States Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, created a waste management hierarchy that categorizes the steps necessary to manage the microplastics to benefits people and reduces the impact on the environment. As you can see on the screen, upside down triangle, kind of. The most preferred method of the waste management is source reduction and reuse that follows recycling and composting. After that, we have energy recovery. The least preferred method for the waste management is treatment and disposal. So let's look at what kind of subjects we have under section 6. In our online guidance document, mitigation and prevention strategies are organized in four general topic areas. Section 611 gives information about reducing plastic packaging and increasing plastic reuse. And we have improving production efficiency under Section 612, including life cycle assessment and alternative analysis of plastic product and material substitutions to prevent regrettable solutions. And under Section 613, we are talking about reducing the consumption of plastic products by reducing their appeal to consumers, especially through education. The last one, Section 614, it is about improving the disposal of waste and advocating for recycling and recovery of plastics waste. So these strategies are really, really important, improving plastic sustainability throughout the life cycle. What is life cycle assessment? Life cycle assessment is a tool used to assess the environmental impact of a product or process from beginning to end and identify strategic improvement opportunities, such as sustainable solutions to avoid regrettable substitutions, social and supply chain impacts. The use of plastics can be reduced by using alternative, recycled, or non-plastic biodegradable materials, improving the design to reduce the amount of plastic use, extend product life, allow repair and reuse, and improve recyclability by limiting the number of polymers, additives, and mixtures. And last one all is banning some certain types of single-use plastics, of course. As you can see on the screen, this figure shows the life cycle assessments stages in the 3D printing process chain for additive manufacturing. Considering the different specificity of these manufacturing processes, a broad field of opportunities emerges actually to develop more sustainable means of production of different levels of chain values. This shift goes from design and manufacturing optimization, for example, part and assembly, until the synthesis of advanced materials into the final product. So, the worldwide microplastic contamination issues can only be controlled by incorporating responsible and sustainable practices into the production, use, and waste disposition of different plastic materials, as I mentioned earlier. Significant reduction is in plastic consumption and waste generation can be achieved through product substitution and, of course, education. As shown in this figure, the details of reducing plastic consumption can be found in Section 613 of the guidance document. How we can improve the waste disposal of the plastics when you think about it. This can only be achieved through performing some global initiatives that involve education and buy-in on waste minimization practices, expanded collection services for reuse, recycling and disposal, reduced production of non-reusable and non-recyclable materials, and of course, further improvements to recycling processes. North American and European countries typically have organized public or private waste collection services, but a large of the world's population, unfortunately, does not have access to an organized collection of waste for disposal at properly designated landfills, and even less for recycling, for which options are often not affordable or not available. There are several options for managing plastic waste. As you can see on the screen, we listed as like source collection and post-separation disposal, reuse or repurposing, waste energy and feedstock, landfilling, bio-based and biodegradable plastic alternatives, electronic waste recycling and enhancing distribution, storage, transportation, and stormwater control. But I would like to mention that regarding the bio-based and biodegradable plastics, being bio-based does not make it any more biodegradable or any less likely to create microplastics. These products are recyclable through the normal recycling pathways. That wraps up my first part of the presentation regarding prevention and mitigation. Before we move into discussing remediation technologies, I would like everyone to use the chat function to comment one thing that can be done to reduce microplastics intake. Let's give us just 20 seconds for that. Thank you. I can see lots of nice ideas like do not microwave, buy real clothing materials. Reusable glass. Yeah, there are lots of nice ideas that I can see. Here is another potential action that can be done, or already they performed this study anyway. This is a case study where the installation of washing machine filters shown to significantly reduce the number of microfibers reaching wastewater treatment plants in a community in Ontario, Canada. You can find the details of this case study in Appendix A6 of our guidance documents. Now we will be moving on the abatement portion. If I can move, it seems like my doesn't work. What's happening? Okay. Right now, I think I move it.
Yeah,
So
Yasmin, that
the
was sorry, that was me. Would you like me to move them for the rest of the?
yeah, I think it's gonna be better.
Okay. Yep, I
I
got you.
think I have some problem with internet connections, probably. Thank you. So now we will be moving the abatement portion of my presentation. We describe the treatment technologies in the guidance documents under the section 6.2.1 through section 6.2.4. These are organized by media based on the degree of development and implementation, as well as also confidence in the technology based on peer review literature and professional judgment of the authors. We use two levels of implementation confidence, which are field implemented technologies and developing technologies. Field implemented technologies are technologies that have been demonstrated under full-scale conditions at multiple sites by multiple practitioners and multiple applications, and are well documented in practice or peer-reviewed literature. Wastewater treatment plants and drinking water treatment plants are some of examples for the field implemented technologies. Developing technologies are technologies that have been researched at the laboratory or bench scale, but have not been field demonstrated. Often these results are reported by only one group or lack detailed validation of the treatment effectiveness or mechanisms. For example, acoustic focusing, electrochemical oxidation, magnetic extraction are some of examples for developing technologies. Next slide, please. This is a figure 6.5 from our microplastic guidance document. Because wastewater treatment plants are we have lots of study from the wastewater treatment plants, so we wanted to use wastewater treatment plant as an example for this meeting. So this flow diagram shows a conceptual estimation of microplastic removal and also retention in different stages of wastewater treatment plants. The different stages include preliminary, primary treatments such as grit chamber, grease removal, primary settling tank. Secondary treatment, such as activated sludge reactors, bioreactors, and secondary clarifiers. And at the end, we have tertiary treatments, such as disk filter, granular filter, rapid sand filtration, membrane disk filter, coagulation, and flocculation. As you can see on this figure, removal efficiencies in the individual treatment stages range from 2 to 75%, but when you combine all stages together, 94 to 99% of microplastic removal was observed for a combination of primary, secondary, and tertiary treatment processes. Next slide, please. In the guidance document under the section 6, there are only two tables, table 6.3 and table 6.4, showing the treatment technologies by media. Table 6.3 provides a summary of potential treatment technologies for removing microplastic from drinking water, surface water, groundwater, marine, and wastewater. Table 6.4 provides a summary of potential treatment technologies for soil. Unfortunately, there is no table available for air since there are very few studies conducted on atmospheric microplastic only. Also, I just want to bring to your attention that the screenshot that we can see as table 3 is just a small portion of the very large table that outlines, I think, almost 24 different treatment technologies. Next slide, please. So just focus on one of the tables, so how you can use these tables very efficiently. Here we have a closer look at six table 6-4, which covers potential treatment technologies for soil. When we look at the first column, can you click please? When we look at the first column from left, shows the treatment category, if it is biological, chemical, or physical. Disease follow with treatment technology. When you look at the top of the row, treatment technology, media, advantages, and efficiencies, and at the end, we have references. Kind of arrows. These arrows are showing. Can you click again, please, to show the arrows? These arrows here are showing how the table indicates if treatment technology is a developing technology or field implementing technology. Also, it is important to note that the removal efficiency percentages, excuse me, shown on this table are based on laboratory studies that have not been fully implemented in the field. Next slide, please. Let's wrap up what we went through together regarding the mitigation and abatement. Source reduction to reduce microplastic in the environment is really critical. In order to minimize the negative impacts from plastic pollution, different stages would have to be considered simultaneously, not only reduction in the use of plastics and their replacement by other alternatives such as cardboard or biodegradable polymers, but also eco-design, environmental education, improvements in waste management, and others really important. Based on the literature review, including the studies that we did go over today, it is obvious that existing treatment technologies that implemented in the either wastewater treatment plant or drinking water treatment plant, they have been showing different success to reduce or remove microplastics. It is also very important to consider management of waste produced during the treatment of microplastics. This is the end of my presentation. Right now, I am turning over Todd Miller from Kennedy Jenks to wrap up today's training. Thank you.
Thank you, Yasmin. Before we get on to the final Q&A session, I'm just going to provide a brief wrap-up of what we covered today. excuse me. Just a brief reminder that the guidance document is a web-based document that can be found on the ITR website, and the URL is shown here. In the introductory section, we presented the definition for microplastics and why we should care about them. They're ubiquitous and persistent in the environment. They contain harmful chemicals, and they're consumed by animals and humans, resulting in potential health and environmental impacts. In the fate and transport section, we describe primary and secondary sources, how microplastics are released into the environment, how they are transported and where they end up, and various degradation pathways. In the sampling analysis portion of the training, we describe the state of the science for sampling and analyzing microplastics, as well as concerns that can impact the results. During the human health and ecological effects portion, we describe pathways for human and ecological exposure, the challenges of reviewing and comparing microplastic study results, how particle size and chemical makeup play key roles in the effects, and briefly presented tools available to evaluate health risks. In the current regulation section, we presented the key results to the ITRC group's poll of 25 states, which showed at the time of the study, only three states had sampled for microplastics, and no states had regulatory criteria. Several are considering some form. During the mitigation and abatement portion, we discussed best management practices that focused on keeping plastics out of the environment by reducing the use and developing alternative products, educating the public on alternatives, and improving recycling. As a reminder, throughout the document, you'll see this CSM figure. In the introduction section, clicking on each of the dots will bring up a short description of how microplastics are found in the environment. In subsequent sections, these dots will link you to associated sections of the text. Section 7 of the document describes data gaps regarding microplastics knowledge and/or information. Fate and transport, the fact that microplastics are found nearly everywhere we look, but the transport mechanisms are only partially understood. For sampling analysis, there's a need for better reference standards, better analytical instruments, and lower costs. Health risks, impacts to human health and the environment are not well understood. Additionally, how changes in the physical and chemical structure of microplastics can impact our ability to fully assess the risks. For trophic transfer, there's a large need to better understand the impact that size and shape have on how microplastics move through the food web. And for mitigation and abatement, the need to for replacement products, as well as better practices to control and remove microplastics from the environment. There are six case studies featured in Appendix A of the Microplastics Guidance document. Case study one is the California approach for microplastics, which describes the legislation and other activities that the state of California is taking related to microplastics. Number two is consequences of microplastics on various ecological endpoints in the Chesapeake Bay and its tributary estuary, the Potomac River. This case study focuses on the effects of microplastics on three organisms found in the Chesapeake Bay: the hooked mussel, blue crab, and the striped bass. Case study three is the impacts of disposable PPE and single-use plastics during the COVID-19 pandemic, which explored the effects of increase in single-use plastics related to COVID-19 pandemic. Case study four was Nurdles Along the Gulf Coast, which describes a notable spill of plastic nurdles into the Mississippi River. Number five is effects of 6-PPD quinone on coho and chum salmon. This case study presents an evaluation of the tire wear particles' impact on acute mortality in coho and chum salmon and details mitigation efforts to decrease the transport of tire wear particles to surface. And case study six is washing machine filters reduce microfiber emissions to aquatic ecosystems, which describes a policy brief prepared by Toronto, Canada. We hope that you take time to review these case studies to gain more information. I'd like to bring everyone's attention to the ITRC team that started in February 2023, referred to as the Microplastics Outreach Toolkit. The team utilized the information contained in the ITRC Microplastics Guidance document to create an outreach toolkit that contains products such as downloadable fact sheets and social media campaigns, and to provide clear communication to the public about the extent of the problems presented by microplastics, how people and our environment are being affected by microplastics, and what citizens can do to help reduce microplastics. It's our hope that the Microplastics Outreach Team Toolkit will provide valuable resources for environmental professionals to engage with and educate clients, regulators, and the public about microplastics. This slide presents a few of the examples from the Outreach Toolkit. And now I'll turn it over to Taylor from ITRC to facilitate the final Q&A portion of the training.
All right. Thank you, Todd, for wrapping that up for us. And since we are getting close to the top of the hour, I thought I would ask our trainers one question in the Q&A box. I was actually asked twice. This question was, how should we safely dispose of the microfibers captured by those filters? They're referring to the idea of using filters in washing machines.
That's always a good question. Don't use a plastic bag. throwing it in the trash is the best way to dispose of it. But the ultimate answer is any way we can get it in the landfills without it becoming secondary released through either, windblown transport or, just dropped off a truck, which is always the problem when you're looking at, trash pickup, is going to be a consideration.
Yeah, also do not wash them, otherwise it's gonna introduce as a secondary microplastics in the wastewater treatment plant, whatever it goes.
All right, thanks, Todd and Yasmin. And since we are a little over 3 p.m., I will go ahead and wrap up the train today. So thank you all for interacting with our trainers through the Q&A pod. And we did try to get to as many questions of yours as we could today. Thank you again to our expert trainers for being here and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would like to hear back from you, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form. I did post that in the chat. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. And thank you all again for attending the training today. Bye.